Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary, not valid for McDelivery.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by author Tom Parker. Tom wrote the fantastic book Avoiding the Terrorist Trap. And today we take a look at the events of September the 11th and their legacy on counterterrorism. I hope you enjoy this episode.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Tom, welcome back to the podcast.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you back on. Just for the benefit of listeners who didn't hear our previous interview, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your kind of professional experience?
Absolutely. It's quite an odd career. I'm basically an investigator by training and background. I started out as an officer in the British Security Service in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Spent 4 years working for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia as a war crimes investigator working in the Balkans. Served with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and then sort of took a bit of a left turn, working for several different human rights organizations, including as the policy director for terrorism, counterterrorism, and human rights for Amnesty International USA. And I've done several stints with the UN since, and also as a consultant working in Iraq for more than 4 years, for example. And also in Africa and a little bit in Latin America and Southeast Asia.
Excellent, excellent. So we're here to talk today about the sort of 20th anniversary of 9/11 and its sort of legacy. So I was just wondering, I wanted to sort of start off with, how has 9/11 impacted you? And do you have any memories of that day?
I have very, very strong memories of that day, actually, for a variety of different reasons. I was actually in Mostar in Bosnia. But my wife and son were flying out of Boston that morning.
Yeah.
And so obviously, you know, the first I heard of the events of September 11th, you know, one of the things I heard was that it was a plane out of Boston that had flown into the World Trade Center, and my wife and son were flying from Boston to New York. So that was panic number one. My brother-in-law is a New York City firefighter.
Yeah.
So that was panic number two. My in-laws live in Lower Manhattan, so that was panic number three, and I was thousands of miles away. So, the challenge for me immediately was to try and get hold and find out what had happened. And I always remember it was very hard to get through to New York in the aftermath of the attack. And I remember getting hold of my sister-in-law, and you know, very, very sensibly very smartly, not knowing how long the connection would last. She answered the phone by just saying, "Everybody's safe."
Yeah.
Then my wife ended up getting back to New York by train. And she is, back then, was an expert or very experienced person working at mass grave sites, particularly with families that hadn't been able to recover the remains of their loved ones. Having worked in the Balkans on mass graves and war crime stuff. So she went straight down to Ground Zero and volunteered, working with family members who'd lost, you know, first responders who'd been killed in the events, and spent the next 3 or 4 months working right down at Ground Zero with families. So it was very, very close to home. I knew a number of firefighters who died. I'd actually been at a golf day 2 weeks beforehand with one of the firehouses that was wiped out. So yeah, I mean, it was a very, obviously a very impactful day. The job that I was doing at the time was investigating, war crimes committed by Mujahideen volunteers in central Bosnia during the Bosnian conflict. These were Arab volunteers who, much like the Arabs that went to Afghanistan, had come to Bosnia in the early 90s to fight alongside the Bosnian government. And a number of those individuals were people who went on to be sort of founding members of Al-Qaeda. So we also found ourselves as a team sitting on a lot of information about individuals who, you know, could now be involved and active members of Al-Qaeda. So, you know, professionally, right from sort of September 12th, we were, working in an area where there were strong connections to the organization that had been behind the attack. So yeah, September 11th for me was very much a sliding doors moment. Nothing was quite the same afterwards.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. I mean, crikey, that's, you had a lot of connections there. And that story about the firehouse and then your wife, having to assist with, volunteering to assist at Ground Zero. That must have been very hard for her. And you were saying she was there for what, 4 months?
Yes. No, she's a professional social worker who specialized in, you know, she'd worked in Srebrenica and in Kosovo before. So, you know, she was mentally prepared, you know, for what she encountered, I guess. But it's, of course, very different when it's your people in your hometown. And my wife's a New Yorker. Of course, she knew many of the firefighters because, you know, it's a tight-knit community. And, you know, we have family members in it. You know, I have a nephew-in-law and a brother-in-law who are both New York City firefighters.
Yeah, wow. So with regards to then Al-Qaeda, and obviously with your connection in Bosnia, what sort of key things did you learn about how Al-Qaeda, were thinking? And what were they trying to achieve? And do you think the West has sort of fallen into their trap they laid?
Well, obviously, as the author of a book called Avoiding the Terrorist Trap, yes, I did think that we fell into the trap that was laid for us. But to take your question very seriously and look at what do we know about the planning and the aspirations behind the 9/11 attacks, the picture's a little cloudy. You can find evidence to suggest that it was always the intention of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda that they would provoke the United States into an action like invading Afghanistan that would become a quagmire for them. And you can find evidence to suggest they didn't anticipate that. History is messy and complicated. It's just possible that bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and people around them said different things to different people. it's hard to know without sitting down and, you know, asking people who were in the room what the thinking was at the time. And many, if not most of those people are dead now, with the exception of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a couple of people in Guantanamo. I think at best, it's hard to give a definitive answer. What we can say with certainty is after the fact, they certainly engineered a narrative to suggest that the idea had been to provoke the United States into invading Afghanistan, where it would ultimately come a cropper. And you can find very explicit references in bin Laden's speeches to that concept. He has this parable that he tells about Bush. He says, Bush is like the cantankerous old goat that kept digging up the knife that was eventually used to cut its throat, you know, which is obviously a fairly heavy-handed metaphor. But also in online treaties like the Administration of Savagery, you can again see a deliberate articulation and detailed and thoughtful articulation of how this strategy would play out. So, you know, it's very hard to say with absolute certainty that bin Laden's plan on the 9th of September was to set a trap for the United States. But what one can say with certainty, provoking an overreaction for the authorities is a typical and central terrorist tactic. And it wouldn't be remotely surprising that bin Laden would be thinking in those terms, because terrorist organizations typically always think in those terms.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess from bin Laden's point of view, there was no guarantee that all of the planes would have been successful, because just looking at the kind of coverage that's been shown in the last few days, obviously we know about the three planes that were successful, the two that hit the Twin Towers, the one that hit the Pentagon. And then there's talk of a fourth and possibly even a fifth plane. In the fourth plane, which was United 93, I believe, and that was sort of taken down by passenger action. There's still debate to where that plane was intending to go. Was it intending to go to the White House or somewhere else? You know, and it's if it had hit the White House, I wonder what the other response could have been. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting one.
I think the likelier target would have been the Senate.
Yeah.
Washington was certainly the target. I think they were heading in that direction and had turned clearly to a heading that would have taken them to Washington. When you hear aviation experts or experienced pilots talking about the difficulty that it would that an inexperienced pilot would have had hitting a target that is ultimately as small as the White House, you know, you think of the situation of the Senate building, which is, you know, at the end of a very clear, visible mall. You know, then it's obviously on a hill, Capitol Hill, and it's a very prominent target. I think it would have been an easier target to actually hit. But again, there's no certainty as to what that ultimate target was. I don't think the impact would have been particularly different, right, if it had been the Senate or the White House. Again, you know, they'd hit the, you know, a symbol of American financial power. They'd hit a symbol of American military power. I think it's entirely logical they would have tried to have hit a symbol of political power as well.
Sorry, very random question. Do we know if bin Laden was a Tom Clancy fan? Because Tom Clancy wrote a book in which a plane did hit the Senate building, but it was
flown by a Japanese pilot.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
I have read the book purely because of that connection.
And
there were, of course, instances. I forget, was it the Clinton White House where somebody landed a plane or flew a small Cessna onto the White House grounds?
Yeah.
So, you know, there had been histories, but more significantly, I mean, first off, I think the first response would be it wasn't bin Laden's plan, it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had actually played with a sort of a different precursor plan called the Bojinka plot, which was a plan to hijack or actually get bombs onto about 7 to 9 airliners flying out of Southeast Asia out of the Philippines during a visit by the Pope. And they actually did a dry run for this plot, which successfully got a device onto an airliner, I believe a Japanese airliner, which detonated and killed the passenger under which the bomb had been hidden, but did not bring down the aircraft. I think that was in 1995, if I remember correctly. So, you know, the genesis of the 9/11 attacks goes back quite a long way. Now, that was an attempt to bring down multiple airliners, and the idea of multiple airline hijackings goes back to the Dawson's Field operation by the PFLP back in the 1970s, where there was the simultaneous hijacking of 4 airliners, but they were all taken, well, 3 of them were taken to the same landing field, Dawson's Field in Jordan, an old RAF station. And if I remember rightly, I think the 4th was too large to land at that airfield and ended up somewhere in North Africa. But, you know, you can see sort of precursors or echoes in history that would have informed some of the thinking, I guess, for the people planning out 9/11. They wouldn't have had to have turned to fiction for inspiration. There were, you know, real life events that had happened within their community's memory that would have certainly prompted some of the ideas that they had. And I think I'm right in saying the first attempt to use an aircraft as a weapon by a terrorist group would be socialist revolutionaries in Russia in 1905, 1906.
Yeah.
There's an attempt, a very early attempt to use a biplane it's not successful, but there is a plot. I've never been able to find that much out about it. There's a passing reference to it in a book about the terrorists, because Russia in the early 20th century was swept up, and for that matter, the late 19th century was swept up in, you know, quite violent, wide-ranging terrorism, anarchist and socialist in origin, and reactionary fascist terrorism from the Black Hundreds. I mean, thousands and thousands of people were killed. And that's one incident that I've seen reference to.
Interesting. Well, thank you for that. So I suppose one big question here is, do you think the threat of Islamist-inspired terrorism was overblown post 9/11?
That's a great question. I think you'd have to say no. I can't think of any terrorist attack in history that becomes remotely close in terms of impact and just in terms of death toll and loss of life as 9/11. Yeah. I mean, the 9/11 attacks are by an order of magnitude worse than any terrorist attack carried out by any other terrorist group in history. So it's difficult to overplay the significance of that. You know, if you look at the death toll of more or less 3,000 people, you know, killed on the 9/11 attacks, that's actually more than was killed in the number of people killed in the Pearl Harbor attacks, although the number's quite similar. I mean, it was a tremendously significant attack and made all the more significant, I think, by the fact that it kind of came out of a literally and metaphorically clear blue sky.
Yeah.
I don't think you can underestimate that. It was an incredibly purposeful and dramatic act. And any country having received, been on the receiving end of an attack of that nature would have been compelled to respond as if it had been attacked by a hostile state. That doesn't mean I think that's the appropriate frame within which to respond, just that it's entirely logical that a state would respond in that way. And I think the very fact that it had so many kind of parallels with, I've thought about, you know, often reflected about this, it has so many parallels with the Pearl Harbor experience, you know, an enemy, albeit the Japanese didn't declare war and Bin Laden had actually declared war twice. But it still has that feeling, right? It's a surprise attack, but the death toll's the same. It kind of drags America into a conflict it hadn't wanted to be directly engaged in. We make decisions by analogy. You know, there's a lot of social psychology research on this by a range of, you know, sort of academics specializing in social psychology, psychological approaches to decision making. And, you know, we know that presidents and prime ministers often make decisions by using analogies that sort of give them a shorthand for understanding situations that they face. Probably the most famous example is Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis and the number of times in cabinet discussions that, you know, the XCOM, the executive committee that's running the response to the crisis, the number of times in debate they reference, you know, the Munich crisis. And, you know, Hitler's threats on the Sudetenland and, you know, invasion of the Rhineland and the comparisons with Hitler and the fact that appeasement allowed him to grow and strengthen. Is this that moment? Is this the moment we should stop? And of course, using Nazi Germany in 1938 as a way to understand the Soviet Union in the 1960s is probably not the most useful prism to look through. But nevertheless, it's, and, you know, it helps people reach decisions. It was fairly similar, I believe, with Eden and the Suez Crisis and the way that he, you know, the framework or the lens that he used to try and understand NASA was very similar. You know, the comparisons with Hitler. And, you know, I think the same thing happens in the counterterrorist context. I mean, we reach for, you know, experiences that we have and we understand to make sense of something new. I mean, how many times does one hear, you know, in the UK, I mean, I remember, I think it was after the 7/7 bombings where the commissioner of the police, Sir Ian Blair, said, oh, it's been a terrible day, but it's not the Blitz, right? And how many times do British policymakers and politicians reference that World War II experience as a way of, you know, as a useful shorthand or comparison for locating something in the panoply of threats, you know? So I don't think the way that the United States responded or the way it treated Al-Qaeda as a threat was necessarily unsurprising or indeed inappropriate. It was the manner in which it responded or acted on that identification of the threat that perhaps, well, not perhaps, is where I think it went wrong.
Yeah. And well, you know, a lot of commentators are, you know, have been reflecting on the past of 20 years. And we've just had the recent withdrawal from Afghanistan. We've had the droning of what was supposed to be an ISIS-K person. It may have turned out to be an innocent person. We've got, obviously, the legacy of drone warfare. You've got Guantanamo Bay. All sorts of things that have gone on that have sort of helped I suppose, Al-Qaeda propaganda in many respects. And so it's 20 years later, one has to ask oneself, what could Western security services have, or even in particular the CIA, have done better to tackle the threat from Al-Qaeda and obviously now the more recent threat from ISIS?
Two different questions there, because of course the CIA is not a security service, it's an intelligence service and has a different role to play. I think domestic security services responded quite well, actually, to the threat, and quite appropriately within the context of Western Europe, certainly. I think the FBI also responded quite appropriately. I think there are some issues around entrapment that are worth exploring, but the FBI essentially used the law enforcement tools at its disposal within a law enforcement framework to respond to the threat, and it did so, I think, really quite successfully. You know, one of the important takeaways from the 9/11 Commission report, it wasn't a lack of tools that resulted in the American intelligence community's failure to pick up on the 9/11 attacks, the planning of the 9/11 attacks. It was a failure within the intelligence establishment to successfully communicate the intelligence that did exist with the people, you know, and bring the people that needed to know it or could act on it into the room so that they could join up the dots. The dots had been recovered. You know, they had the dots. What they weren't able to do was effectively analyze the dots because they didn't have the right people in the room seeing the dots. And that didn't require new laws, new powers, new, more sophisticated equipment. It required better cooperation. And I think, you know, one thing that the UK does incredibly well is cooperation. I think we have a very well connected intelligence and security establishment, probably more so than almost any other country in the world, certainly up there with any I can think of. You know, the United States, it's more complicated. You know, the United States security establishment, you've got 20,000 plus police forces, you've got 50 states, you've got, you know, 25 federal intelligence services. You know, it's a much harder beast to get your arms around. But the UK, where you only have single figures number of players, it's much easier, and you know the organizations are much smaller, and the cabinet architecture controlling those organizations is more evolved. So you know, I think we do that sort of thing well. Where you see breakdowns in the British security response, it tends to be one of capacity rather than capability. I think Eliza Manningham Buller put it very well. She said there are acute challenges of prioritization. Right. You can't follow everybody. You do have to make choices. You're not always going to make the right choices. That's understandable. I mean, you cannot be prescient all the time. But, you know, in a week where MI5 publicly stated that it prevented, 35 attacks in the last 3 or 4 years?
Yes.
You know, that's a pretty good track record, and assuming that they're reporting accurately. And frankly, I have no reason to think that they wouldn't be. So, you know, I mean, I think the security side of things has been pretty good. I think one of the reasons it's been pretty good is when you're operating within a domestic sphere, you have to operate within your own legal system. So you have legal constraints that stop you from making the kind of mistakes that we see external services making. And that's where we come to the CIA in your question. And of course, operating overseas in secret, in the shadows, out with the law, out with oversight, becomes a lot easier to do the kind of things that actually blow back on you really rather badly. Like, for example, the use of coercive interrogation in black sites. And I think that's where you see many of the critical mistakes that were made in the aftermath of 9/11. And there, I think our response has been very counterproductive.
It's becoming very popular today to paint kind of Western counterterrorism with regards to 9/11 as just racist. And I was just wondering if that's fair, because I don't know, I find like if your enemy is presenting themselves as Muslims and identify as Muslims, then it's difficult not to want to then, you know, target Muslims. So I don't know. It's I don't know if you had any sort of thoughts on that and that interpretation of things.
I think the short and unsatisfying answer is yes, it is, and no, it isn't. You know, I mean, I think your observation is accurate to the sense that if you are fighting or being attacked by an enemy that uses a narrative based in faith to justify their actions, it's going to be very hard to get your arms around that problem without that faith being an element of how you think about it. But at the same time, that is also going to drive prejudices. You are likely to make assumptions based on very little or flawed knowledge of other cultures. And in responding in an overbroad manner, you're likely to make the situation worse. There's a concept coined by an academic called Paddy Hilliard called suspect communities, right? That you know, if by creating a threat and a counter to that threat, you create a community of people who suddenly find themselves lumped in with the actual threat, which is always a fringe of a fringe, a total minority within that community. But it becomes very difficult to have a response to that community without, you know, making decisions that are based in very generic, wide-ranging, swinging thinking. And you know, we did exactly the same thing in Northern Ireland, and that's what Hilliard was talking about. He was talking about the creation of a Catholic or nationalist or Republican suspect community in Northern Ireland through legislation that focused on prescription of predominantly Catholic organizations or nationalist or Republican organizations. Was that racist? I don't think that would be the correct term for that, but it's the same phenomenon that you're kind of referencing here. And I think as an analyst, you'd have to accept that race and gender and ethnicity are always part of the equation. And it can play a positive and a negative role in both the way that people act and the way that people respond to those actions. And I think, you know, part of an effective policy is understanding those biases in yourself and resisting them, particularly when they are going to be counterproductive. We all have them, you know, the unconscious biases of all sorts of different types, you know, based on our past experience, our community's folk memory, I mean, and all the rest, and institution, you know, the institutions of modern society. I mean, all of these things create, you know, trammeled thinking and, again, shortcuts and you know, stereotypes and, yes, the allocation of you know, false narratives to communities, faiths, populations. So, I mean, I think you would have to have a conversation about how race was part of what happened, but it was on both sides, right? I mean, you know, you can't talk about, you know, the Zionist imperialist enemy and, you know, the various, you know, epithets that you know, groups like Al-Qaeda use about Jews and Westerners and Zio Crusaders and all of that. You know, it's just as racist. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I've spent, you know, almost 4 years of my career working in Africa and almost 4 years of my career working in the Middle East and 4 years of my career working in the Balkans. They were all racist places, right? You know, I mean, every society has it. Every society has its in-groups and its out-groups, its biases. Those biases are more powerful and more dangerous when you are more powerful and more dangerous, hence the, you know, the concept of white supremacy and the damage done by white supremacy. But it doesn't give other groups a pass. You know, we're all responsible for our own actions. And we're all responsible for the way that we see the world and the way that we interpret the events around us. And I think what I would say is that any good investigator and any good intelligence officer tries hard to understand the biases that inform particularly instinctive reactions and tries to put them aside and be more analytical in their approach, because yeah, that's the best way to understand the other side. It's you can't understand somebody using stereotypes, right? Because they lack nuance. You know, so to be effective in your counterterrorist response, you have to get beyond those kind of biases and prejudices. And I think good investigators, good intelligence officers do. And there's a lot of them. So, you know, if you're asking me, do I think that the police, well, let's say the security service is institutionally racist, I think that would be an unhelpful description because I think they spend a lot of time thinking about those issues. But inevitably, you know, they are, you know, just as we all are, prisoners of their background culture and inherent biases. So, you know, I mean, yes and no. It's a very unsatisfying answer, but I think it's facile to try and say, you know, one side's bad and the other side's good, or one side's enlightened and the other side's prejudiced. I mean, it's just, that's not how the world works. We all have prejudices. Our position in society, our privilege, if you like, you know, means that some people's privileges, some people's biases can do more damage than others. But even that's contextual, right? You know, I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda didn't murder Westerners because of the things, a lot of the Westerners that they murdered because of the things those individuals were doing, right? They murdered them because they were representatives of their community. You know, that's a form of prejudice too, right? And a form of stereotyping too. So I don't know. I think it's important to be aware of the significance of these issues when you're dealing with complex problems. I don't think it's particularly helpful to hurl insults at people if that's how it's being used. What is always helpful is to try and promote understanding, right? Mm. You know, and try to cut through the crap and try and have real connections between people based on what, you know, the values that those people are representing and want to, you know, want to project. And I think that's, you know, that's always a challenge for everybody. But I do think that intelligence officers and investigators, they are in the business of trying to see past that. You know, you can't be a good intelligence officer if you don't. So, yeah, I think it's an important issue to raise. And I think it's an important issue to think about. But I think it has to be thought about in the round.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Because, no, it's just, I've noticed today, it's just very popular, mainly on Twitter and obviously, you know, around the current sort of race debates that are going on. And obviously these very important debates, because obviously there's been some dreadful things in the States and sometimes mm-hmm. Britain too, of the police involving, you know, sort of minority communities, and they've behaved very badly. And now, you know, sort of the intelligence services now under and security services are kind of being painted that brush too. And I just find, I feel like there's some bits where it's fair and some bits where it's not.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just get the impression there's a lot of nuance missing from these debates these days.
Yeah. But it is also an important conversation to have because, you know, with, you know, there are those people out there that want to profile, right? And that's, you know, of course, you know, one way in which, you know, quite easily you can see prejudices come into play. In a way that's tremendously unhelpful and again only makes things worse. So, you know, I mean, I think from every perspective, it's worth considering these kind of criticisms, not least because if people are raising it, they feel it to be true. And so you have failed to carry those voices along with you. So you probably should be worried about that. Mm. You know, if somebody's telling you that they feel singled out and they feel like they're on the receiving end of racism and prejudice, yeah, there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
you know, and so you definitely want to explore that and try and understand it. Mm. But it's, you know, as you say, it's also a label that can be thrown around. Mm. What I always want to see is the evidence, right? I want to see the and I don't know enough, frankly, about the scene in the UK these days, having not lived in the UK for 20 years to comment on it authoritatively. But look, I mean, I think you should always listen to criticism, right? Because they might be right, you know, and so it's never a bad idea to listen to people who are telling you you're not doing something well, because, you know, as I say, there's a possibility you could be doing it much more effectively and much better.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal, each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets.
It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary, not valid for McDelivery.
We may have already answered this, actually, but did the security services and intelligence services get anything right in its response to the terrorist threat from Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
So, as I said before, I actually think they've done a pretty good job. And, you know, I mean, what's become quite obvious over the last 15 years has been the degree to which the Western intelligence services were able to penetrate Al-Qaeda far more extensively than I think was initially appreciated. That's using human assets, people like Amin Dean or Morton Storm. You know, these were very well-placed assets that were reporting on exactly the kind of people you would want well-placed assets to be reporting on. So I think that there were definitely some reversals. The Hassan Balawi case, the Pakistani Taliban were able to turn a CIA asset, Jordanian CIA asset, and use them as a suicide bomber against his handlers. You know, that's probably, you know, the most high profile example of a failure. But there have been a tremendous number of intelligence successes. And, you know, I think that if you look at electronic intelligence gathering as well, ISR platforms, the ability to surveil huge areas from the sky, you know, I mean, there has been an incredible degree of intelligence gathering success, I think, over the last 15 years. As is so often the case, the real challenge is what do you do with the intelligence? You know, and in that sense, I think we've seen rather more missteps. But when it comes to intelligence services doing the core tasks that intelligence services excel at, which in the security services cases are is investigations and in external services, intelligence acquisition, I think you'd have to say the track record of most Western intelligence services has been pretty good.
Mm. And one of the obviously downsides of intelligence is that successes can't always be reported, can they? But failures can.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think most agencies are quite keen to find ways to report their successes, actually. Obviously, without revealing their assets and their sources.
Yes.
and making sure that they protect and guard ongoing sources of intelligence. But at the same time, I mean, you get funded because you're successful. And when your failures are public, you want to make damn sure that the people that need to know about your successes are made aware of your successes. And there are mechanisms within Whitehall for doing that. And I'd imagine there are in other countries as well.
Yeah. And what kind of key lessons have been learned with regards to counterterrorism policy that's sort of enacted today?
That's a couple of different ways to unpack that question. I think the first is to say that history teaches us that we're not very good at learning lessons,
yes.
Even if we learn them in the short term. In the long term, we tend to disregard and forget those lessons. So I would query the first assumption in this question that is just because we have learned some lessons that these lessons will stick. They probably won't, if history is any guide. But I think that it's the same lessons we always learn, right? That torture doesn't really produce information. It alienates people. It alienates the population. It disgusts your own citizens. And it degrades the institutions that use it and the people that use it. Mm. Killing people is not an easy route to victory. That there's very rarely a finite number of people you have to kill to win. That is because terrorist organizations are dynamic. There's always people joining and leaving. But also people join for a reason. And if your behavior is the reason why they are joining, then if you continue that form of behavior, you're going to have more people join the terrorist organization, right? So if you're seen as a brutal imperial power and your response to that is to extend your power into foreign countries, then probably you're just going to create more terrorists. There's a great quote from an interview with an Al-Qaeda asset by Amaryllis Fox, who's a former CIA officer. She was a clandestine service officer, and I think she ran for Congress. But she wrote a book about her experiences, and she has this lovely conversation where she's talking to a recruitment target, I think it is, in Al-Qaeda. And the Al-Qaeda guy says to her, says, "You Americans, you love your movies, you're Star Wars and, Indiana Jones. And, but the mistake you make is that you think you are Luke Skywalker. You think you're Han Solo. You're not. You're the Empire. We're Luke Skywalker. We're the rebels." And that's quite an interesting way of looking at things. And it's quite an important insight. Because everybody's the hero of their own story, right?
Mm.
Narratives only have sustainability if they're powerful, enduring, and most importantly, basically true. You can spread lies, but ultimately lies, what was Churchill's famous phrase, that a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth pulls its trousers on?
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
There's truth in that. But I think, the thing about truth is it is actually quite hard to tear down over the long term. The counter cliche will be the truth will out. And, lies, ultimately, they can fool people one or two times. They can fool a small minority of people for an extended period of time, particularly if they play to their prejudices. Mm. But ultimately, 9 times out of 10, what wins these conflicts is who wins over the great mass of undecided people. The people who have got open minds, who are willing to be persuaded about which side is more right than the other side. And you ultimately do that with truth, most powerfully. You might get short-term hits with lies, but over the long term, what people can see for themselves, taste for themselves, have confidence in, those are going to be the things that they will make decisions based upon over the long term. Ultimately, I think it's really, really important that we understand the arguments that fuel terrorist recruitment and people, support for terrorist organizations, because they're usually grounded in some compelling facts, right? If you're a Palestinian living in the Gaza Strip, it's pretty easy to see a compelling, rights-based, justifiable narrative why you should be pretty angry about your situation and why violence may be the only way to change it. And that doesn't make that violence right, and I really don't believe it does, but it does make that violence understandable. And you can't solve the threat based on that narrative until you understand it.
Mm. One just quick thing back to what you were saying earlier about lessons not being learned. Do you think that's down to institutional memory and people and turnover of people within the various services over the years?
I think that's part of it, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the missteps are basically intuitive and makes sense to human beings. The idea that if I punch people in the face or I scare people, they will tell me the truth. It makes some sort of intuitive sense, right? I think our culture plays a role in this. You know, when did you last see a TV show about a police officer where the police officer played by the rules, right? They're always mavericks. They're always fighting against the system. They're always going outside the lines, right?
Well, they make a big thing about red tape, don't they? Yeah.
No police officer ever says, you know what, I really think we should follow procedure here. There's solid reasons why we have these procedures in place. Mm. We need to respect the rights of the suspect because, let's face it, he is innocent until proven guilty. A speech I have never heard in a cop show ever.
Yeah.
Right? You know, they're all crazy, maverick-y types who, you know, haven't got time to follow the rules, you know?
Mm.
That stuff does infect society at a fairly profound level.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you look at the movies that are made about the classic example, Zero Dark Thirty, you know, a very good movie about the Bin Laden raid.
Mm.
You know, it's compelling. It's wonderfully filmed. And it has a whole section about how torture works and how the CIA effectively tortured people for information. It's absolute bullshit. I mean, it's completely untrue what's represented in the movie.
Mm. On your notes about popular culture and violence, I vaguely remember, and I could be wrong in this memory, but I'm pretty sure I'm not, when the Abu Ghraib, those terrible events happened, apparently some of the soldiers had mentioned the TV show 24 and Jack Bauer's character, not necessarily as a direct influence, because it'd be unfair to put that on Kiefer Sutherland's shoulders, but all the creators of that show, but they certainly, you know, sort of seeing that kind of, you know, his character's willingness to torture and do sort of things on a weekly basis and sort of break the rules certainly was a point of inspiration for some of the events that happened, some of the abuses that happened among soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I have heard of that. I'm not 100% sure how accurate that is because that was a long time ago I heard that and I read that somewhere. There was certainly a lot of talk of that. And I think there's a lot of interesting things to be said about the connection between popular culture and not just violence, but also misunderstandings about how things work. You know, because I've spoken to some very, what I think are intelligent people who, you know, think that MI5 go round assassinating people who are of an inconvenience to them. And I'm sure there may be some MI5 officers who would love to be able to do that, but I don't think they can. And I don't think they do. So, you know, and I think a lot of that's inspired by popular culture.
Yeah, I think popular culture can encourage people to commit abuses. You know, I mean, we were talking earlier about the way that people use analogies to inform decisions. You know, and we talked about how that might be misleading if your analogy is grounded in a historical context that's different to the one you're facing. Well, it's an even more dangerous strategy when the analogy you're using is based in fiction or fantasy. Mm. So, I think there's definitely an issue with the way that popular culture handles issues like interrogation. And, you know, there have been efforts by human rights organizations, I think most notably Human Rights First, that actually had a project where they reached out to Hollywood screenwriters, brought in experienced military and police interrogators to talk to them about how, you know, what actually does work in the real world rather than what is dramatically powerful. But in the movie Zero Dark Thirty, when the scriptwriters were challenged about their made-up example of torture working in the movie, the defense they ultimately offered was it was more dramatically satisfying rather than the truth, which was actually torture hadn't produced any information that was relevant to the Abbottabad raid. In fact, in the real world, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded and asked questions about Bin Laden's courier and lied to cover up his identity and his significance. So in fact, in the real world, they're using waterboarding as a technique to elicit information, produced the contrary effect of the one they were looking for. So, that is very, very frustrating for career professionals when they see the Hollywood portrayals on television. And of course, it does influence people. It influences people. There was a case in New Orleans recently where a policeman was in a car chase and he drew his weapon and fired through his windshield at the car in front. Now, this is, in the real world. Well, no police officer in their right mind would ever do that, right? Not least because, the bullet's going to get deflected when it hits the windshield. Mm. Now, John Wick does that, and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis. But in the real world, you don't fire your weapon like that while you're bouncing around in a car, and then there's people around. I mean, it's an act of madness. But again, it's the sort of thing that sort of comes out of watching too many movies, and then imagining yourself in that kind of role. So I think you can lay a little bit of blame at Kiefer Sutherland's door, but no more at his door than anybody else in Hollywood that's producing movies, where they use these kind of very thoughtless scenes. I don't think there's any ill intent behind it. I think it is mostly driven by narrative and drama, but the problem is it does seep into the public consciousness and it does create false impressions of what does and doesn't work.
Oh, massively so. I mean, you see it even in shows that shows that are not particularly violent as well. I mean, I've even seen it in superhero films. That happens often. I think it was Daredevil. I was watching the first series where the lead character does something to someone, and as a filmmaker myself, I mean, I call that lazy writing. It's this sort of dramatic shorthand that people use. They do it the same with sex scenes as well, and there's been a lot of debate in the last few years about the way sex scenes are used in films. And there was a debate at one time about torture and violence in films, but I think that debate seems to have, it kind of comes up and disappears and comes up again. But it is a constant battle. It is a battle. It's trying to find that balance between being entertaining, but at the same time not doing long-term damage, because we're in the business of mass communication, and it's something I maybe over worry about these things sometimes, but I take it as a big responsibility when you're in the business of mass communication. If you're making a film that feels realistic and then characters start doing something like they were in Zero Dark Thirty for dramatic purposes, I feel that's kind of a bit morally repugnant personally.
And it's so unnecessary, because it's not like the About a Bad Raid is an unexciting and non-dramatic story.
Yeah.
It's one of the most impressive military special operations of all time. You didn't really need it. So I think in that film of all films, it's particularly gratuitous. Mm. With that heavy dose of irony that it's the exact opposite of what actually happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know with that one. It's such a strange one. It was, it's a very strange film. I rewatched it not long ago, actually, and it just totally taints the film, that beginning, because it is a very interesting story.
It does, and it's a good film. And in fact, we use some of the clips from that film, particularly the searching of Bin Laden's house, because there's a big debate at the moment about battlefield evidence collection and what sort of standards troops in the field should be held to. When they collect evidence. One of the things I always say is there's no FBI agents on the About a Bad Raid, right? When the Navy SEALs go into the house, right, they're soldiers carrying and executing a military mission. They grab a bunch of stuff. They put it in bin liners. They take it back to Bagram Air Base. That's when law enforcement gets involved, intelligence folks first and then law enforcement. And that doesn't invalidate what they brought back. You just simply collect statements from them about where they got it from. And, you can see that they're photographing the scene, and, there's plenty of evidence to take to a courtroom about the provenance of what they have recovered, and thus its reliability and value as evidence. It's very interesting. It's one of those movies that, as you say, I mean, it's tainted by one unnecessary scene. Mm. Otherwise, I think it's really good.
Yeah, yeah. Is Islamist-inspired terrorism as great a threat to the United States and the West today as it was perceived 20 years ago?
No. I don't think so. I don't think it's over as a threat, and I still think it is a very significant threat. I do think it never was an existential threat, and it certainly isn't an existential threat now. I don't think you can say quite the same thing about right-wing extremist terrorism in the United States, which has far deeper roots in American soil, going back to the Ku Klux Klan and the Red Shirts and the period after Reconstruction in the American South, through subsequent iterations of the Klan in the early 1900s and in the 1950s and 60s. And, as we've seen you know, in January the 6th. Now, I wouldn't call the storming of the Capitol terrorism, but there's evidence of the very real and present threat that right-wing extremism poses to democratic governance in the United States. It's a very powerful illustration of the damage that this fringe movement could do. And because they are from within American society, and they are embedded in American institutions, including in the police and the military, and for that matter, in the House of Representatives, to a lesser extent, the Senate, and in the White House. You know, you have people who are prepared to countenance, you know, lies about the outcome of an election and overthrowing a democratically elected president. That is the very definition of an existential threat to American democracy. And that is a threat from within, not from without. Mm. You know, so that's the phone call coming from inside the house, and that's far more frightening to me than you know the very real threat posed by terrorist groups on the other side of the world, whose best efforts at hurting us will be expeditionary, because they aren't living and embedded in our societies in the same way that right-wing extremists are. And so, you know, I think it's a very significant threat. I think it is an enduring threat. I think it has received a huge boost from the Taliban's victory in Afghanistan, a huge boost. But I don't think it has ever arisen to the level of an existential threat in the same way that threats that are rooted in one's own soil have the potential to become.
So my next question is, what is the level of threat from Islamist groups in the Middle East and Africa?
There are still many Islamist groups. Al-Qaeda is still around and going strong. ISIS is still around and going strong, not as strong as it was, but still very significant. There are terrorist groups operating in North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, Central Asia. Yeah, so there's no shortage of Islamist groups. I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon, although at the same time, I don't think they'll necessarily endure forever either. If we look at the history of the rise and fall of different terrorist organizations and movements, you know, at some point, particularly if your appeal is essentially theoretical, spiritual, or ideological, as opposed to grounded in, I want my town to be free, you know, something very real and oppressive, right? You know, if it's not a question of liberation, then typically those movements are a wasting asset because, you know, the longer that they go on without achieving their objective, the less credibility they have. And so when we look at ideological groups, whether it's anarchists, Marxists, fascists, you know, they typically have, you know, a limited period of time to deliver the goods, or they ultimately wither away and get replaced by something else. If the underlying reason remains that is causing discontent in society, it will probably just find expression in a different way. So, you know, perhaps the underlying drivers of terrorism won't go away, but they'll find different forms of expression in those societies. In societies that are experiencing some form of occupation or perceived occupation, I think it's different, right? That's going to continue until ultimately, you know, they are free. You know, and if history teaches us nothing else, it teaches us that there's only a limited amount of time that you can keep, you know, people in a society against their will.
Thank you for that. Well, as you just touched upon just a few moments ago, I mean, obviously there's this growing threat from far right groups and even conspiracy based groups like QAnon. And do you feel that threat or that potential threat from these groups is being taken as seriously as Islamist inspired terrorism was 20 years ago?
No is the short answer to that. I think it is being taken more seriously than it was by the Trump administration, clearly. So I think we have seen a change in the way that the federal authorities are responding. Although, in fairness to the authorities, not to the Trump administration, but to the independent institutions, you know, the FBI was investigating things like the plot on Governor Wilmer, and you know, I mean, they weren't ignoring right-wing extremist terrorism, far from it. And I think it is, you know, it made its way into policy documents as a potential threat, REMT, as it's called here, called in the United States, racially and ethnically motivated terrorism. You know, so it wasn't being ignored. It perhaps was not being addressed quite as aggressively as it could have been. And that's a profound understatement, actually. But at the same time, there's some benefits to a softly, softly approach. You know, as we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast, you know, if you overreact, if you go in hard, you do run the risk of pouring, you know, oil on the fire. So you have to be careful how you respond. You have to give space for dissenting voices to express themselves. And you have to draw a very clear line between radical speech and violent speech, or violent extremist speech. And I think that's a very difficult line to draw sometimes. And there's plenty of people who want to tiptoe up to the edge, but not cross it. There's a politician at the moment in North Carolina who specializes in that. You know, these kind of coded statements that really are quite inflammatory, but are just the right side of, you know, not being actionable. You know, and I think that's definitely a challenge. But I think you do have to allow speech for dissent, even when that dissent is vile, or even when that dissent does aim to tear down the foundations of the society you live in. But talk is cheap, and it's when talk turns to action that I think, you know, you have a moment when you can intervene. And it's particularly difficult to police speech in the United States. You know, I mean, the free speech protections under American law are actually stronger than the free speech protections under international human rights law, you know, which does very clearly recognize that there are categories of speech that are not protected. You know, American law is less convinced of that. So that does pose unique challenges. And, you know, the right wing has always had, and certainly if you go back to the last iteration of right-wing extremist terrorism in the United States during the Clinton administration in the 90s, you know, they had this narrative of jackbooted federal officials and black helicopters and Ruby Ridge and all of that. And, you know, if you play into that, you do, you know, fan, you know, the flames of their rhetoric and of their appeal. So I think there are real, real challenges there. But I also think there's a lot you can do by painting, you know, a Nazi as a Nazi. Yeah. You know, it's still not a very popular brand in the United States. And so I think it's worth drawing those comparisons, you know, for all of the ease with which that, you know, that epithet, that description is thrown around in, you know, in conversation. Oh, you're a Nazi, or that's, you know, that's fascist. There are objective characteristics to, you know, far right speech that can be called out and can be compared to, you know, the type of language and rhetoric that we do associate with Nazis and other fascist organizations, you know, through history and in the present day. And I think you call that speech out when you see it.
It's interesting you mention black helicopters and all that sort of stuff in the 90s, because one of the most popular shows was The X-Files, and then obviously the film Men in Black. And it's just really interesting how, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, how kind of conspiracy culture and sort of far right sort of symbolism kind of interlink and then become mainstream. And it's just, I find that really fascinating.
No, I think you're right. And you know, in many ways, you could argue that the X-Files was sort of one of those watershed cultural moments. But, you know, at the same time, you also have to look to why was the X-Files, why did it exist in the first place? Why was it a cultural project? You know, and that obviously was a reaction, you know, lies told by politicians, things like Watergate, Iran-Contra, all of those things, right? So it's not like it's just a cultural phenomena. I mean, we pay a price when people in positions of authority behave badly. You know, whether that's lying to cover up an affair or lying to cover up malpractice, it does erode trust in institutions. And, you know, our institutions have suffered greatly, I think, over the last, you know, 3-4 decades from, you know, a systematic and sustained assault on their credibility by oftentimes the people in those institutions themselves. You know, the lies around the invasion of Iraq, the, you know, as I say, Watergate, Iran-Contra, you know, the Monica Lewinsky affair. I mean, there's a pretty long list. You know, relatively recent historical real world examples of politicians lying to the electorate.
I think that cynicism, I mean, you know, I think of shows like The Thick of It, those kind of comedies about British politics, and I always find, it's so cynical, but at the end of the day, you can't blame them. And it's, and I think that cynicism definitely feeds into a lot of things, like, you know, which led to things like Brexit, if you want to consider that a negative thing, because some people might not consider Brexit a negative thing. So, but it's, no, I find that cynicism of politics really interesting. And I think there is something to be said about, you know, politicians just routinely sort of lying that kind of makes matters worse on multiple levels and is probably more of a threat than terrorism is. But there we go.
Well, look, here's the thing. I mean, trust is incredibly hard to earn and it's really easy to lose.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you add to that people's desperation to believe in something, you know, there's particularly when it's in the political realm, you're inevitably going to be, you know, disappointed because, you know, politics is the art of compromise, you know, and to get attention, people have to stake out positions that they know they're never going to be able to, you know, play out in you know, the real world politics when they get into government or even when they're in conversation with government. A great example of that would be Nick Clegg, right? And his pledge to abolish university fees. I don't doubt for a minute that was sincere, you know, but, you know, it crashed up against, you know, the politics of being in a coalition, you know, particularly with a party that wouldn't be sympathetic to the sorts of things you want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and you know, I think it's very hard to be an honest politician. Because it's a job that requires not dishonesty, but it requires being able to renegotiate your position and the values that you are defending to reflect the reality of what needs to happen to achieve a goal. And, you know, that makes sense to people who work in politics. It doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people outside politics.
Oh, so true. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, I think probably the best place to start and where I would love for them to start is to pick up a copy of my book, Avoiding the Terrorist Trap, Why Respect for Human Rights is the Key to Defeating Terrorism. You know, if they've found some of the arguments that, you know, we've discussed today interesting, they'll certainly find a lot more about along those lines in the book. So that would be a great place to start. They can find me on Twitter, you know, at TDG Parker. That's also, you know, a potential. I like to, you know, I tend to tweet mostly about terrorism. It's mostly factual stuff, about these issues, but mostly sharing information actually that I've, you know, seen in places that I thought was useful and insightful. So, you know, if my curated, terrorism library would be of interest to you, Twitter's a great place to go to.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal, each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary, not valid for McDelivery.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.